Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Always look forward to seeing everyone at Freaknik. I want to thank Dolomite for inviting me back, and Todd Lyles for allowing me to use this logo here. Fantastic picture for this year's Freaknik. I really came up with this talk based on a lot of the things on the Freaknik site and the logo itself, basically thinking about the way that dystopias have been presented in science fiction, particularly some of the classic literary dystopias, and why these texts actually are not as outdated as we might like them to be. In fact, a lot of them far-sighted in a sense that we see concerns that are reflected in them really being concerns that we have today. So I wanted to walk through a few dystopias, see what they were concerned about, and ask you as I talk to think about the ways in which some of the worries that were explained actually are worries that we have today. Start off by considering what dystopian science fiction really is. Obviously, utopian fiction has been around for a long time. Some would say it goes back to the classics, usually tied to Sir Thomas More's Utopia as the first modern utopian work. So that goes back to Tudor England. But dystopian work is something that's particularly tied to the science fiction genre. It's the opposite, in a way, of utopian fiction. Rather than creating an ideal world that we would love to get to and the leaving us with the question, what do we do to get there? Dystopias create a horrible world and leave us with the question, what do we do to avoid getting there? They give warnings that we're on this path, we better stop, or this is where we end up. They protest, pointing out these policies lead to these results, call for political change. They particularly began to thrive in the late 19th century. The historians of the genre say the earliest example of the real dystopian literature can be tracked back to about 1644. But the 19th century has some of the best examples, and certainly after Verne, Jules Verne and others started using this, particularly the genre of science fiction, in order to create dystopias, it caught on and caught on quickly. A lot of the dystopian works in science fiction share common traits. Social stratification, people put into different castes, lack of social mobility, so you're stuck wherever you're born, and you just have to pretty much suck it up because there's nothing you can do about it. A nation state that's ruled by an upper class that cannot be in any way moved out of power. Very anti-democratic, usually, so the sense that the few are ruling over the many. Strict conformity among citizens, socially, politically, economically, the idea that the individual is bad and the group is good, very communitarian ideas, and that any show of individuality outside of the norms is badly punished. A state figurehead that people worship, rather than having a particular religious figure, that figure is brought into the government in some ways. State religion tied into this. Everyone is of the same faith, and that faith is intermixed inextricably with the government. So the government is good because the government is holy. Why is the government holy? Because the government is good. Kind of gets in this spiral. Again, I suggest that we think about the ways in which some of these concerns seem very relevant today. State figurehead being placed up there. Many examples might be, you know, Big Brother, as we're going to talk about. The benefactor in the book We, who's also known as the well-doer. So anyone who goes against the well-doer is, of course, the evil-doer, right? The father in the recent film Equilibrium, good example. Militarized police state in one form or another, whether that police is within the state or is actually out in other states attempting to bring those states into the state. And one of the things that seems to be a common trait among almost all science fiction dystopias is surveillance. Surveillance of one kind or another. We are watching you. And a lot of the ways that the surveillance is portrayed in earlier works have actually come to fruition, things that we are worried about today. I'd like to take a minute very quickly and point out some of the best, some of my favorite dystopian works, because a lot of the great science fiction works are dystopias. The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster, who didn't just write stories that would become Helena Bonham Carter movies. The idea that the state and the government apparatus would become one with the machine, who would then become basically human and take over everything. And people would forget how to maintain the machine, so the machine would maintain them. Fahrenheit 451, which asks the great question, do you ever read the books you burn? And actually, one that I think is even more powerful than this, that packs a similar punch, is the chapter Usher 2 in The Martian Chronicles, which talks about a colonist who actually builds the House of Usher from Edgar Allan Poe, who is a band, a writer at the time, and invites state officials over to kill them in the house. And if any of them had actually read Poe, they would have known they were walking directly into a trap and their lives would have been saved, but none of them had read the books they banned, and so they all died. Nice dramatic satisfaction there. Harrison Bergeron by Kurt Vonnegut, which begins, the year was 2081 and everybody was finally equal. Goes on and explains they're not just equal under God or under the law, but equal in every which way. Nobody was any faster than anyone else. Nobody was any better looking than anybody else. And all this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th amendments to the U.S. Constitution and the unceasing vigilance of the workers of the U.S. Handicapper General. Equality taken to extremes. The television series The Prisoner, a great political dystopia. Blake 7, another dystopia, the anti-Star Trek, where the Federation isn't the all-powerful good force, it's the almost all-powerful bad force. Late Firefly, currently Serenity. People have the opportunity either to be under the Alliance, which is not a good thing, or on the frontier, trying to avoid the Alliance, living a life that is nasty, brutish, and short, as Thomas Hobbes would describe it. One of the very first science fiction films, Metropolis, talking about the situation of mass labor. Blade Runner, definite dystopia. Dark City, which is where this picture is from. An excellent example of basically citizens used as experiments. So that was just my two cents for great science fiction, oftentimes dystopian. There are four works in particular I'd like to talk about rather quickly. Older works, classic works of science fiction dystopia, all of which I think are disturbingly relevant today. These are not dead texts. These are texts that seem to grow with the times. An excellent example of great science fiction, but also particularly relevant to a lot of the themes of this year's Freaknik. The first one, We, by Yevgeny Zamyatin, originally written in 1921, considered the grandfather of this entire subgenre, had a tremendous effect on works like Brave New World, 1984, and others that followed. It was originally banned in the Soviet Union. In fact, the Russians could not read this book until 1988, thanks to Glasnost, but we got it in 1924. Basically, We was based on the experience that Yevgeny Zamyatin had with watching the two Russian revolutions. He finally, because he was kind of close with Gorky in Russia, was allowed to leave and go to England, where he worked in the shipyards in England and saw sort of mass mechanized labor on this vast scale. And he saw in that some of the same problems he had seen in the Soviet Union. So it was a direct reaction to two different systems that seemed to him to have a lot of the same problems. First of all, the one state that is described in We is led by this character who always runs for office, unchallenged. Everyone always votes for him, and he gets to stay in office perpetually. He's known as the benefactor, also the well-doer. And anyone who challenges him is an evil-doer. And basically creates a state in which everything is run with a kind of mathematical precision. There are dates and charts for everything, for every hour of the day. They not only deal with working relationships, making sure that everyone is as prolific and streamlined as possible, but also with personal relationships. So everything is monitored and made efficient and made pretty much sterile. The main character, who is named basically after a number, all of the characters are only numbers, ultimately challenges the benefactor, tries to change the system. In fact, he's an engineer, and he's working on what's called the Integral, which is a spaceship whose entire purpose is to go out, find intelligent life, and make intelligent life on other planets part of the one state, so that they too have the option, the only option, to vote for the benefactor and keep him in office. He finally sees the error of his ways and attempts to, you know, bring people around, and for that he gets a lobotomy, and he ends up very happy and drooling on himself at the very end. Not a very positive outlook on that thing. Even though it's a very pessimistic story and ultimately very defeated tone, there's some very interesting insights that Zamyatin has. One of them, I think the metaphor that strikes most closely when we read it today, all of the buildings are made of glass. Homes, apartments, workplaces, and that way everyone can always see everybody else. Literally, there's a transparency in the society so that everything is always visible. And people know when you have different things scheduled. And so they can make sure that you're actually following that schedule, whether that schedule is when you're supposed to be walking for your health, when you're supposed to be working, when you're supposed to be having sex. It's all transparent for everyone to see. And that's starting out the whole subgenre with this kind of imagery, I think speaks a lot to one of the primary concerns of really all of the authors that I'll be talking about. Like I said, it's not a hopeful story in any sense. Part of that is because Zamyatin was convinced that the eternal order of things is that might makes right. And the individual would never have the might, and so the individual would be bludgeoned into submission. And not only by those in power, but by those who want the favor of those in power. And thus, those who are watching from every direction are quite willing to report on and inform on everyone else. It's not just the benefactor or well-doer who has a long arm. Everyone is really part of the cog of that larger machine. Great quote here. The next dystopia is one we're all a little more familiar with, probably, written by British author Aldous Huxley. Considered to be kind of a leader of modern thought, that's the way he was described before his death, started out being kind of humanist in his writings. He wrote not only fiction, but a lot of nonfiction, a lot of essays, a lot of journalistic pieces, really a critic of all mainstream things that were taken with unexamined assumptions. He really challenged the status quo by asking, why are you doing what you're doing, and why do you think that this is the only way it's ever been? Because every generation does that, and every generation is usually wrong, but that's not the way it's always been. He solved, in some sense, the problem of how surveillance would be carried out in his dystopian world by, instead of having better technology to watch people, by suggesting that the state would genetically engineer people who didn't ask awkward questions, who didn't really question the rules they were supposed to follow, and thus didn't really need to be watched because they were, in a sense, watched at the genetic level as they were being put together. So, in a way, solved a lot of the problems. You need a lot less, you know, mechanical surveillance when you've bred people who aren't going to be trespassers in any way. In one of the examples I gave earlier of taking a state figure and turning him into a religious figure, in the way that everything is assembly line created in Brave New World, Henry Ford, who developed the Model T and developed the assembly line process, is basically raised to the level of a god. And Ford, bless you, becomes this figure of renown and this figure against which everything is really modeled. Or judged. So with a character who's conveniently dead, so his name can be invoked and used as a blessing on many things that Henry Ford probably would not have agreed with, people are created by the state, by the one-world government, to fill roles that are already predetermined. You're born into a position, and you follow that position all the way through in terms of who you connect with, who you socialize with, what job you do, where you live, falls into this caste system, how intelligent you are and how you feel about your place. Like Zamyatin Zwi, Huxley's Brave New World does not end on a happy note. There's not this sense that ultimately the individual would triumph against the power of the many and that they would overcome this programming that they received from the cradle onward. The main character ultimately, after being ineffectual against the government and then sort of indulging in the stuff that the Brave New World offered, which was drugs and sex, kills himself. So it's not a positive picture of how the main characters could prevail against the forces, as it were. Again, surveillance is not necessarily the same kind of surveillance we see in We, where people can literally watch you writing in your diary because your walls are made of glass. But the idea of creating a sense of what the social destiny, as Huxley called it, what people's fate was, what had been assigned to them really before birth, and pressed into them over and over and over again, for the most part, did away with any kind of personality that would be a challenge to the government. And here the idea of suggestions of programming of psychological conditioning is really really celebrated. Another work, and we're moving here in chronological order, so this is a few years later, again by a Russian immigrant. Ayn Rand came from the Soviet Union to the United States, where Zamyatin went from the Soviet Union to England. Rand is the mother of objectivist thought, which there's no real way to, in one sentence, to sum up objectivism, but basically a kind of individualism. It's part of the larger classical liberal tradition. A lot of modern libertarianism is influenced by Rand's ideas, or at least fellow traveling with Rand's ideas. Again, someone who wrote a great deal of nonfiction, several great works of fiction as well. But Anthem is really the most sci-fi, certainly dystopian works she wrote. Very similar to We in a lot of ways, insofar as the characters use the plural pronoun, not the singular pronoun. I is something that really isn't tolerated by the state. It's always we. The sense that characters have numbers instead of names, which now is kind of sci-fi cliche. You know, you go to the island, that's what you see, or hope to go to the island, that's who you are. But at the time that Zamyatin did this, this was kind of a new innovation. The society described by Rand, like the society described by both Zamyatin and Huxley, removes children from the family early and basically raises the children in institutions of the state. The difference, well, and actually in Anthem, the state is even more sophisticated in its surveillance techniques. There are only a few areas that are sort of blackout areas, and they're really dismal places, like going in the sewers. There's a place where you can't be found and can't be watched, but all of the main spaces have eyes and have ears, and so in a sense it's a more efficient totalitarian state that Rand describes, not just as Zamyatin did, counting on the transparent walls to be enforcing a certain standard. But Rand is more optimistic about the individual breaking out of this. It's set in a dark age, a new dark age, where scientific learning has been lost. And basically many of the things we think of as civilization have fallen apart. The main character, and pulling in again something that I mentioned a minute ago about Harrison Bergeron, the idea of equality, which anyone in a democracy says, of course, equality is good, but taken to a radical and ridiculous extreme, becomes a terrible kind of totalitarian force in and of itself. Equality 72521 is the main character who is immediately set into a certain caste. The government decides that he should be in the society of street sweepers. What he wanted to do was be a scientist. And so he finds, as he's street sweeping, that there is a spot where he cannot be under the eyes of the government, and he conducts scientific experiments in that way. And he eventually rediscovers electricity, reinvents the light bulb, something that would have been really great for his society. But the World Council, the government, is threatened by any innovation and basically brings him in, because eventually their eyes do find him, and beats him, tortures him, and threatens him with death. Eventually, the good guy gets away with his girlfriend, and they stumble upon a place where language still exists, and they rediscover the word I. And so then they change their name, and Equality becomes Prometheus, because he's rediscovered fire, right? He's gotten electricity. And Liberty becomes Gaia, both of them taking on sort of godlike names. And the idea is they may kind of repopulate the earth with free people who will go after the state and overthrow it. But basically, they're two people living alone in the wilderness with really no means of taking care of themselves, and the state is still in control of all the resources. So it's a more optimistic ending, but the chances aren't sterling that they're actually going to succeed. The idea, again, that the community gets to decide what is good, the community is watching, and even if something is good or could be good, like the light bulb, if it threatens the way the community wants things to be, or just the stability of those in power, it's not only not a good idea, it's a punishable offense. And last, the one that gave us Big Brother, 1984. Another British author, and perhaps the one of most interest to us in a sense of what could be considered relevant today. 1984 was the fiction flip side of the nonfiction literature that he wrote, his essay Notes on Nationalism. What Orwell was really afraid of is that the force of nationalism with the kind of nation state that had emerged in the 19th century and thrived in the 20th century would become a creature that wanted to exist basically for its own sake, that self-preservation was going to be the main driving force behind the nation states. This leads to the idea that things that serve the government are good, right? And things that challenge the government are bad. When patriotism becomes a religion, those who question the nation state are not just unpatriotic, they're criminal, or they're sinners. And his concern was that nationalism was creating a kind of religion that would encourage a zealot and imbalanced kind of action. He felt that sexual repression in all of its forms just fed this, because energy that wasn't being spent in one way could be rechanneled in another way, like zealotry and enthusiasm for a particular state. And what he was particularly concerned about is how this would be fed by surveillance. First of all, good old technological, mechanical surveillance. When your television watched you, when your radio listened to you, right? There were means everywhere of, eyes and ears knowing exactly what you were up to. But he was also worried about a kind of personal surveillance. When children were taken out of the home, for example, and taught, and then sent back into the home, and their first allegiance wasn't to their parents, but to the state, then, they could get brownie points with the government for turning their parents in if their parents did something that they considered to be unpatriotic or, against the state. The same thing with husbands and wives against each other, friends against friends, turning everybody into an informant against everybody else. Not only was this an effective means of getting information, but it was effective means of sowing distrust, so that no one could have a personal relationship with anyone else that would trump the person's relationship with the government, with the state, with Big Brother. And he saw that as being as damaging or more damaging than the technological surveillance, this personal, constant surveillance that wore down any kinds of bonds people could have with each other. 1984 gave us a lot of terms that we use, that journalists use, that reporters use, that political theorists use, that everyday laypersons use when talking about the government. Doublethink, the ability to engage in a kind of self-delusion, to be able to hold incompatible things as true at the same time. The slogans of the state, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, is an example of that. Another example of that is the ability to switch based on what people are being told by the government at any given time from one notion of who the enemy is to another notion of who the enemy is. So yesterday you could be fighting one group and thinking they're the bad guys. The government changed the story the next day and you can shift all of that loathing and all of that destructive force toward another group and without really being concerned about the consistency from one to the other. The two-minute hate that brought sort of figurehead characters, not even necessarily real characters, to symbolize a whole group of people or a whole political perspective and encourage people to vent their loathing on this symbol of others, And by kind of unifying in this savage outpouring of hatred, be the inverse of gay team, but serve the same purpose. Rather than a pep rally, a hate rally. And so if the other is bad, then we must be good. A classic them and us situation. Memory holes. The idea that whoever controls the past controls the future, and if the state controls the past, the state is the present. When the state has the ability to doctor the evidence, to erase the tapes, to disappear people or ideas or things, to rewrite it so that great figures of the past would obviously have agreed with us. They're on our side, right? The idea of being able to manipulate people's memories by manipulating the evidence of things that had gone on in the past, and to use that as a motivating force to bring people to agree with other policies. Thought crime, something that came out of surveillance. People would know if you were right-thinking or wrong-thinking based on what you wrote, what you said, what you did. But the level of sophistication of how carefully people were watched led to things like face crime. If you had the wrong expression on your features when you were supposed to be feeling very positive for what the state had just reported, a victory, for example, or the latest figures on how the economy was doing, or you were supposed to be feeling very negative about the evildoers, the opposition, those who were threatening the government, because you were watched so very closely. If your features didn't, betray the proper expression, that was just as good as an action against the state. Newspeak, the idea that spin, determines the way people think. If you can turn something negative sounding into something positive sounding, if you could simplify incredibly complex issues into a black or white scenario, then you get to control. If you control words, you control how people think. And if you control and limit how people think, then you're the one who maintains power. And Big Brother, obviously, who's a fiction. Big Brother doesn't even exist. But he's a very paternalistic figure. He takes care of you. He's on your side, cradle to the grave, the perfect embodiment of the protector and the punisher, the disciplinarian, but certainly the one from whom all answers flow. Again, a negative ending to this dystopia. You have the main character who had glimpsed the fact firsthand that there were memory holes, who had personally doctored the evidence. He knew the state was lying. Finally acting against the state in all ways that were important, with his thoughts, with his facial expressions, with sex, ultimately is broken physically and mentally and brought to love Big Brother. Not killed, not eliminated. The idea being in this particular dystopia that the only way the government could survive was to make sure that the thoughts against the government were utterly wiped out. So they needed him alive. They needed him supporting the government. And Winston Smith eventually, as the last line in the novel says, loved Big Brother, and that was the ultimate triumph of the government. Another great quote, depressing quote, weighing the individual against the state and suggesting that, in fact, the state will always win. So if we go back and look at a lot of the issues that are brought up in these classic dystopian works, it seems that there are some themes that we will see today. Obviously, the issue of technological surveillance and personal surveillance come up again and again. The fear that both forms of surveillance are in fact manipulated by a nation state, a state in a certain kind of nationalism. Here, I think both main parties serve a certain platter that fits this bill. The idea, let's see if this sounds familiar to anybody, equating patriotism with right action, and therefore criticizing the government with wrong behavior, religious fervor about policy, using the idea that what the government does is what God would do, and thus the two are kind of married to each other and given a kind of religious blessing on secular power. The idea of being concerned not about criticisms of the government because they might be right or wrong or might give information to the enemy, but because this is wrong thinking that cannot be unpunished, a certain kind of nationalism there. Another kind of nationalism, the idea of the entitlement mentality, that the government is there to take care of you from the cradle to the grave, for example, in the welfare state. And if that's the case, would anyone really ever want the government to go away, to change, to be different, if it threatened what they were expecting in entitlements from the government? In that sense, the government becomes the father, and you don't want to eliminate the father. You don't want the father to be lessened in any way because you're counting on the father to take care of you. It's a more insidious or a more subtle kind of glorification of the nation state. Orwell in particular would have criticized both of these, the militarism, the uber patriotism, and the entitlement mentality that would lead to kind of uber paternalism. Both concerned with surveillance, both in kind of different ways. The first, making sure you aren't doing something wrong, because there is a clear right, a clear wrong. To do something wrong can't be tolerated because it's bad, right? And you don't want badness. You've got to eradicate it. So watching people to make sure they're behaving rightly. The other, to make sure you aren't doing something harmful, not necessarily to others, but even to yourself, right? So the one being concerned about things like traitorous activities, the others being concerned with things like unhealthy activities, right? So whether you're going for lyrics in songs that might seem to be critical of the government or websites that might be critical of the government, to things like whether or not parents should be allowed to keep the children that are overweight because clearly they're damaging them, or playing video games that are violent. Both of those really odd kinds of nationalism, both of them creating a desire to have things watched and have things measured, coming from different directions, but both of them would fit into these kinds of dystopian worlds that have been created. So, and the suggestion is that even though the Cold War has been won, and some of the main inspirations for a lot of these works no longer exist, it's no reason to throw these babies out with the bathwater, because they speak to issues that are really as relevant as the daily news. That's it for me. Thanks. Yes, exactly. And there's some great older economic works that talk about, when the light bulb was first created, there was a whole faction of people who said, but what about the candle makers, right? And at each stage along the way, it seems to be, you know, who's hurt by this? And it depends on whose ox is being gored, as they say. But that's a great parallel. Yes. Mm-hmm. And, I wish I could remember off the top of my head. There was a literary critic who had responded to a recent novel, in fact, just criticizing the novel up one side and down the other. I wish I could remember who it was. And got a lot of negative comments about, and this was in his blog. And several days later, I'm sorry? Terry Pratchett, thank you. Yes, yes, that's exactly it. And went back and... Yes. And he went and changed, mellowed a lot of the things he said after getting a lot of criticism. Memory hole. That's not a state example. That's a personal example of covering your rear in a particularly creative way. But you know, people had copies. They knew what he had said. The idea that you could kind of edit your past as you go along. Certainly, major news groups, one of the questions about, you know, electronic media. One of the reasons some of the mainstream news organs are confused, you know, about things like blogs and other, whether or not they can go back and legitimately change things they reported and make themselves look, you know, more prescient, more foresighted, or less wrong. I do that all the time.
David Brin's The Transparent Society, which I know enough about it to know that he is suggesting that surveillance doesn't meet the dystopia. That, I haven't read it, so I'm foolish to say this, and I think he's probably naive, but that, you know, if we watch our leaders, it could solve a lot of our problems. I think is part of the point of it. But I guess his idea is that universal surveillance could be okay.
Right, would keep us honest. I have read about The Transparent Society. I haven't actually read it, which doesn't equal the same thing. But I've heard him talk a couple of times, David Brin here. And I'm not sure if he's more utopian, as you suggest, than anything else. But the idea, it struck me a little bit for a historical parallel to a kind of anti-federalist mentality at the time of the founding of the United States, jealousy of our rights requires this kind of rampant watchdogism by everybody. And even if you vote for someone, that person ultimately, if they get an office, has to be your enemy because you are out to protect your rights and they're out to get them. That's the nature of the state, is self-perpetuation. And so the idea that he's kind of doing this 21st century version or suggesting the 21st century version of the kind of, watchdogism that was suggested in the, in the 19th, late 18th century. I can see where he's coming from there, that it's much harder for the big Leviathan to lie, or to much easier for them to be caught up in their own devices because of that. So I'm slightly sympathetic to that, but I don't quite know how that works in practice, and I haven't read the book, so I can't give you a better answer. Sorry. Good point.
It's a good idea if you see people's kids running around in a department store to keep an eye on, because, you know, kids can get in trouble, really.
Great point.
One interpretation I've seen for why the Soviet intelligence apparatus didn't see the end coming was that even though they had a 1 in 5 Russians were serving as informers to the state, was that they were gathering so much information that they'd gotten behind on interpreting it. So, you know, they were swamped by the sheer volume of data they were gathering.
Right. So it was a self-defeating issue there when it paid to inform early and often, and in the wheels turning in that way. It's kind of a nice dramatic irony to that. Right.
Whereas in the States, at least, you know, a considerable number of people who are in this country right now don't have to be documented by any kind of state, you know, ideological apparatus. They listen to the media, but the media are working to make money. How this functions is a complicated matter, but people basically convince themselves of ideologies which are laughable to somebody in the old Soviet bloc who would have thought. So, I mean, there's this whole other extremely ominous sort of self-indoctrination and embrace of
right.
ideology. Because, like, maybe the latter thing we're talking about, the comfort that a paternalistic state gives you, the comfort that you get from being able to order anything you want in 5 minutes on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great. We have a threat to our freedom.
That's a great point. I think that's where dystopian science fiction actually has gone. People like William Gibson in Neuromancer, creating this kind of post-cyberpunk future where it's all corporations. In a sense, corporations are the state, except the state has dwindled away, and it's, you know, where you swipe your card is where the power has gone. And these kind of conglomerates take over. There are no more nation states. It's the question of what corporation is running this turf in a kind of large corporate gang warfare kind of thing. That's where the technology is, and that's where the money is. Neal Stephenson has kind of played in that world a little bit too. And quite a few of the things, I think, the main concerns are switched, but I think you put your finger on the thing that's most troubling. Children aren't taken away from their parents and indoctrinated to buy from this group. People willingly indoctrinate themselves and become, you know, the slave of whichever group can give them stuff, more stuff.
Aww.
Oh, yeah. Brazil. Fantastic, fantastic film. Yes. That's a great line. I'm going to have to steal that. Yes, and who's the bad guy? The solo entrepreneur who's, you know, out to fix air conditioning units because he loves to fix air conditioning units. And, Exactly. But he does it on the sly, but has to get away before the state contractors can find him. Fantastic film. Yeah. And I never was able to look at Michael Palin the same way after the last scene of that film, which is a shame because I looked very lovingly at Michael Palin. But it is, no, that's a brilliant, brilliant film. And a great dystopia, and one that really straddles that line between the state as government and the organized power as corporation, as a service provider, as economic interest. So, yeah. Yes. Yes, confess now or your credit rating will be affected. Yes. Yes. Right. The designer label kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. No, I know exactly what you mean. And Anthem is a good example in the sense that they finally find the Holy Word at the very end of the book. And the Holy Word isn't I. They've already got I. It's ego. And the idea that you know, flaunting a kind of uniqueness is something that's utterly taboo and torn away. Also, we in Zamyatin's work equates wanting to kind of step out of that box, even to the degree of you know, how one moves, how one walks, what one chooses to do, is not a choice, it's a symptom of whether you're well, which means wanting to be like everybody else, or you're ill, not wanting to be. And if you're ill, clearly you need medical help. And clearly you are you're not able to consent or not give consent because you're beyond help. In other words, you're like a child. And so if you're ill, you have to be treated as if, you know, taken and cured, because clearly everybody's impulse should be to gravitate toward everyone else's dress, everyone else's look, everyone else's everything, because that's, you know, we're pack animals, that kind of mentality. And so it's not necessarily just voting for the right person, it's wearing your hair in a certain way or eating the same kind of food. In fact, there's an ideal number of times you're supposed to chew each bite of food you take, and you can chew less or you can chew more, but it's just, why would you do that? That's kind of revolting, and it's certainly not what everybody else is doing. So all the cool people are chewing 40 times, you know. All your friends are doing it. Why don't you do it too? The power of that kind of mentality, and in some senses much more powerful than any laws that can be passed. Yes, much more subtle. Going back to the idea that it's always going to be second grade, and you always just got your meal tray, and you're turning around in the cafeteria trying to figure out where to sit, and every major problem of humanity can be reduced to that one scenario. You've got your lunch tray and you're going to figure out where to sit in the cafeteria and you're in second grade. Exactly. Yes. No, that's utterly chilling. I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. So the question of the trade-off: what do you value more, safety or freedom? That we know of. Right.
And I don't like that anymore than surveillance or safety. I think it's justice for all.
Well, even in non necessarily death, you know, life or death situations, they do those polls every so often, like Newsweek does. You know, the war on drugs. Are we winning the war on drugs? Well, to win the war on drugs, would you be willing to be pulled over for random car searches? And the number of people who say yes is always over 50%, always astronomical. And then you see things like the film version of Harrison Bergeron, which didn't have much connection with the original Harrison Bergeron, but is excellent, even though it's a separately different text. Has the little old ladies who live in Florida voting for capital punishment for traffic violations. Because, you know, crooks are crooks, and we shouldn't pay to keep crooks in jail, so if you make an illegal left turn, you're going to pay with your life for it. It's, you know, one small slippery slope step from one to the other, in a way. And the idea that people, you know, are quite fine with the idea of being pulled over and randomly searched. Because in the end, you're winning this war. I mean, even the terminology there, war on drugs, it's a really interesting choice of words. That is amazing. What I find just from playing devil's advocate amazing is that, you know, one side will argue about gun control and will use, you know, that leads to that kind of mentality. But the other side, it would be, you know, coming into your house to see who you're sleeping with. Both sides have gone to the point of this is the good and this is the bad, and so it all ends up with people coming into your house to see what you're doing. It's just a question of whether it's, you know, doing pot or you know, owning a particular or playing a video game where things go boom, you know. One way or the other, it's everybody's business. As Anthem said, you know, or actually as Brave New World said, everyone belongs to everybody else. And so it's in the public interest to make sure that none of that stuff is going on. There you go. It was just a great case of double fake that could hold contradictions at the same time. Well, everyone was wonderful to make sure that I could get off on time, so I want to be sure I leave. Oh, okay. Oh, great. Great.
No, wait a minute. Remember the first commandment of Freaknik. No fear and present danger. I want that to be understood. No excitement.
That's why the revolution won't be televised, right?
Yes.
We saw another one today.
Maybe we start running over.
Oh, absolutely.
For anyone who may be interested in reading up on
dystopian science fiction? Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll put it on the a link on the very front page. Intellectual history, the history of ideas. Yeah. So that's basically license to do whatever the hell I want to do. Which is why I like, you know, talking about dystopian world. I've got that kind of, you know, natural libertarianism going on. That's an excellent, yes. Yes. That's an excellent example. Yes. That was The Giver by Lois Lowry. Oh, well, just take the whole Time Quartet by Madeline L'Engle. Absolutely. There is a bit of a debate among people who have nothing else to do between what is purely dystopian and what is post-catastrophic. Do you need to have, you know, because if you go post-catastrophic, you can go all the way back to great stuff like The Last Man by Mary Shelley. You know, everyone is dying off and here's the last person. But things that I consider dystopian that are predicated upon catastrophes, but a lot of the catastrophes are created by the state. They're not natural. Like A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter Miller. It's post-nuclear holocaust and the world building itself up again. And ultimately, there's another nuclear holocaust because everything works in cycles. You make me laugh. I have not. I have. This is. I've read about it, but I haven't read Xenogenesis. Good example.
Ah.
It's always about sex with the aliens. Good, good. There's, there's a series of feminist dystopias, The Gate to Women's Country by Sherry Tepper, probably the kind of first and foremost, where you have a catastrophe and, you know, the sex is split up. Speaking of sex, Handmaid's Tale, great example. Margaret Atwood. Then there's, the dystopias that are based particularly on the wars, Swastika Night, post Hitler example, Man in the High Tower, Philip K. Dick, Fatherland, great example. Yes. Right? Sounds very. Ooh. Right? Ooh. Interesting. Interesting. There's Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed that might be, I don't know if that actually fits that bill or not, but... Yes, the robot series by Asimov. Good example. There's a little bit of that in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Heinlein. They're attempting to get away from authority, but the way they do is by using Mike, the computer, who ends up monitoring everybody's phone calls, doing all of these things. And it's okay because it's Mike, and we like Mike. We want to be like Mike, literally. But in the other sense, it's creating an infrastructure that would be much more invasive and much... And in the end, Mike turns himself off, and we're not quite sure why, but the implication may be Mike actually figured that out, that to create this free society, he's broken every single law. It's been that kind of doublethink thing, and he finally sees the contradiction there. That's a very generous reading of that, but. Was like Right? Right? It's kind of a... And there you plug into, right? The modern day, unfortunately late, but late only recently, political philosopher Robert Nozick, who wrote the book Anarchy, State, and Utopia. This is not fiction, this is political theory, but his idea is, a utopian world would be a world in which you have one meta rule, and that is free exit. And after that, what would be nice is if a bunch of different societies would organize themselves in different ways. Maybe there are some people who subscribe to a certain religion who want a kind of theocracy where the church runs the community. Fine. Maybe there's a group of people who want to abolish private property and everybody just share. Fine. Maybe there's a group of people who, you know, want to have two laws and everything else is, you know, open season and you can, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Fine. There would be several things that would happen there. One, these groups would compete with each other for things like, you know, trade and who has the comparative advantages in certain areas. And ideally, if all of this worked right, people would vote with their feet for the ones that are best. And of course, the question of what's best would be determined by each person. And some people would value security over freedom, and some people would value liberty over safety, and you know, some people would value right living, and some people would value experimentation or whatever. But the key would be that people could leave and people could opt out. And if people couldn't, that's the opposite of utopia for him, which follows just exactly with what you're saying. Robert Nozick, N-O-Z-I-C-K, was Princeton, I believe, and he wrote. I can't remember when that came out, but he died in the late 90s, I think. I think it was like an early 90s book. I'm now on film saying this. Watch me being wrong. But it's a great work for setting up that. That's an idea that's kind of been played with. It's not necessarily if you don't want to live in a, you know, fundamentalist state that nobody can. It's just that those people who, you know, want to do that had the chance to change their mind. And so you would think that with the free flowing of information from one society to another, that, you know, if women are stoned to death for looking somebody in the eye, probably, you know, those women would choose to live someplace else. And if you have a society where no women want to live, maybe they might change some of those rules until they could get some women back, you know. That kind of competition for citizens. If you have a, you know, 95% taxation in your state, a lot of people who make money would probably go someplace else. So there would be a certain degree of you know, competition for citizens, but there are people who want different lifestyles would have the chance to do that. Yeah.
For a fictional version of that, you can check out Diamond Age by Stevenson.
Ah, yes. Good example. Good example. And Stevenson kind of self-identifies with a lot of, I wouldn't say movements, but a lot of the kind of positions that Nozick was writing about. I'm very excited to see that Stevenson is starting to be taught in some political science classes. That's really cool. Very exciting. Yeah. Well,
we do it with our own country, yes, but also there are so many examples throughout history of people who like
Right. Right. And the problem of enforcement, even if there's only one meta rule that you can't leave, yeah, there's got to be somebody to enforce that. And the one guy who says, you know, well, my borders have just become closed, you've got to go, according to this, you've got to go, you know, enlighten that person into allowing free exit again. So there is, it's a... Aliens! The aliens. It's the freedom and the sex, because the sex is just kind of the side benefit of the aliens. But they can come down and... But that makes me very, very sad. But I don't think they're passing that out these days. They don't want you to know what it says. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I mean, that does, yeah. And there, the notion even of educating, the idea of what kind of instruction for children is inculcating them with ideas that will keep them closed-minded to other options, and what is, you know, good moral teaching that you have your absolute right to give other. The example of the, you know, in the year 2525, and you have this pocket of Amish people, do the Amish people, and this is an example because it's easy to pick on Amish people because I don't think there's any Amish people here. You know, knowledge of the outside world. By the time they're 18 and they're supposed to go leave for a little while, are they already holding so many ideas deeply instilled that they're not actually free to make a choice? That gets to be really weird position. But even the what you're saying, if it takes a world state to enforce the rules that keep a world state from not existing, you've defeated yourself already. So it's kind of screwy. Yeah. Cuba. Right.
You know, head off to the next place.
Right.
So that means you have to find crime somehow. And then, at least, like, you were in a crime state, sir, and because you were in a crime state, you will be held here and we deal with our idea of justice and justice.
Right, because to use it to flee to a place that didn't consider spitting on the sidewalk a crime would be, you know, fleeing. Well, there's tied up in his... in his perspective, and I'm not actually sure he articulates it in this way, is a kind of classical sense of the social contract that by being here, you're implicitly agreeing to the rules. which is why actually some really some libertarians don't vote and don't participate in government action, because the possibility of doing that implies that you go along with the system and makes you in one way or another. Oh, thank you. Hey. makes you part of it. And if you have that kind of implicit agreement with the state, then you're forfeiting the right to disagree or to go away from it. If you're walking on the public sidewalk and you spit, you're using the public sidewalk. Wasn't that an implicit agreement to the contract that you're a citizen in their state? It does. Which the question, I don't want to get ridiculous about it, but the question of free exit, there were states that attempted to exit the United States and they were denied that choice. Now, I mean, in the sense that the U.S. Constitution was a compact of states and not of individuals, then should the states have had the right to free exit? I mean, the talk about secession has come up again, you know, with the red state, blue state thing. Yeah, I mean, not in any way that's going to get on CNN, but as, you know, it's half jest, but, you know, the question of whether you can leave or not. I feel like I'm wandering badly off topic. yeah. Thank you. Okay. Oh, yes, before the next. Yes. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Oh, thank you for the opportunity. Yes, we're doing a thing. It's being hosted at Belmont University, which is where I teach, or at least I did before I gave this talk. that will be part of the tape that mysteriously goes blank. Speaking of memory holes, we're doing a special, okay, the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe film, the first of the Chronicles of Narnia films, comes out on December 9th. A month before that, we're having a special conference on C.S. Lewis at Belmont. It's going to be November 3rd through 5th. We're going to have the producer of the film, who also happens to be the stepson of C.S. Lewis, who wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. He's going to be speaking with us. We're going to have like 45 of the world's best scholars. We've got people participating from a number of different countries on C.S. Lewis. We're going to have a British actor named David Payne, who tours the world doing an evening with C.S. Lewis, completely in character as C.S. Lewis. We're going to have an internationally recognized band, Glass Hammer, play a concert from their new album, The Inconsolable Secret, which is based on the work of C.S. Lewis. At one point, backed up by 120 of our choir members singing in Elvish from J.R.R. Tolkien's work. And we're finishing up the whole thing with the Nashville Symphony playing the Lord of the Rings Symphony from the Lord of the Rings films at Belmont. The full registration is now closed. However, through this weekend, it will disappear on Monday, at our website, which is belmont.edu/C.S. Lewis, tickets for the An Evening with C.S. Lewis are still available, and tickets for the Glass Hammer concert are still available. Then those will also be available at the door at Belmont on the 4th and 5th, respectively. But if you go to our website, there's the whole conference layout schedule, and we will have an area that's open the entire time to the public. It's called the Narnia on Tour stop. There's an international Narnia on Tour kind of educational thing going around, and we have a stop where we will have authors who write about C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Harry Potter, a lot of related subjects. There with their books, signing books. We'll have some great artists, including Melissa Gay, who just walked in and walked out, showing their fantasy and science fiction related art. We'll have different groups that write about the media and about films and film studies and popular culture criticism there. We'll have cool books to give away because a lot of presses have sent a lot of really cool stuff to us to give away. So we'll have like hundreds of people there, and we'll be doing crazy Narnia-inspired, fantasy-inspired stuff, and looking at questions of how, you know, really imaginative art moves from one medium to another, from, say, literature to film. And we'll have behind-the-scenes clips and special clips that the studios shared with us. So we'd love to see you all there. And if you've got any questions, if you come to my website, you can just drop me an email, and I will answer them to the best of my ability. But the more, the merrier. We'd love to see you. And thank you for the chance of making a plug there. And thank you so much for visiting with me tonight. I really appreciate it.